Welcome to The Wolf Den, the podcast about the business and future of podcasting and digital media. I'm your host, Midroll Media CEO Adam Sachs. I'm happy to say that my guest today is Franklin Leonard. Franklin is the founder and CEO of The Blacklist, which is an annual collection of the best screenplays that Hollywood hasn't yet made, as well as a community around those scripts. Over 225 Blacklist screenplays have been made into feature films, earning over $19 billion in worldwide box office, garnering 171 Academy Award nominations and 35 Oscar wins. Franklin, is that right so far?
Actually, we have updates to those numbers. Yeah, we're actually at just under 300 movies, $26 billion in worldwide box office, 200 Oscar nominations, 40 wins.
Holy shit. Okay. Yeah.
And then...
And you have some best pictures.
Three of the last seven best pictures. Slumdog, Argo, The King's Speech. Eight of the last 16 screenwriting Oscars and four of last year's eight best picture nominees.
Okay. Well, that's a better bio than I was going to give you. So why don't we dive in? Let's talk about The Blacklist first and foremost.
Yeah.
Can you give us what is it? What's the elevator pitch behind The Blacklist?
Yeah. I mean, the elevator pitch is that it's an annual survey of every development executive at a major studio, major film financier, or production companies who have deals therewith. And very simply, I asked them for a list of up to 10 of their favorite screenplays that haven't yet been made. And I aggregate all of those votes up and present an ordered list of the most liked ones. It's really straightforward. It started 10 years ago when I was a development executive at Leonardo DiCaprio's company, Appian Way, and has grown into a sort of Hollywood institutional arbiter of taste on screenplays really quickly, I think in large part because of the success of the films that have been made off of it.
And how many do you select each year? How many get that kind of brand?
It varies from year to year. Typically what we try to do is, based on the number of votes there are, typically about 300 people vote. So usually you need seven votes to be included in the list. The idea there is that theoretically you could have block voting from a production company or a studio where every single executive at the company says, well, these are the 10 scripts that we're trying to get made, so let's just vote for them. So the idea is that we want to exclude the value of that block voting. Interestingly, I think we found that, even though there might be a short-term economic benefit in people doing that, they don't. They actually sort of vote their conscience, if you will, because they know that if everyone votes their conscience, the list as a whole ends up being more valuable for everyone, including themselves.
And so there's a list, and there are a collection of scripts that live on the website itself, right?
No, so those scripts are not on the website. We have a policy of not sharing screenplays with anyone without the explicit permission of the writer. So we gather those votes and we put this list out, and then we're sort of done.
It's not the actual screenplays, it's the names of the screenplays.
It's the title, author, the representation information, so agency and agent, management company, manager, if there's a producer attached, if there's a financier attached, and then a log line that we usually source from the voters. And then we just sort of toss the list out into the ether. We literally put it on the website and we email it to everyone who voted. And then it goes viral overnight. Everyone starts reading it. And then, begins the process by which every executive, every agent, every manager tries to get together copies of those scripts that they can read over the holidays. And a lot of times now you'll see there'll be a run on scripts that were on the previous year's blacklist in January and February as people that may not have been aware of them or are now giving them a second look with this sort of branded element of the blacklist sort of endorsement on it. And a lot of these scripts get acquired or start moving faster towards production after the list comes out. I've always said that sort of the influence of the list is sort of fundamentally unknowable, but in aggregate, it's fundamentally undeniable.
And what's the business model?
There is literally no business model behind the annual blacklist. That list is something that I started 10 years ago when I was working as a development executive. It literally happened. That list was created because I was trying to find some good scripts to read for the holidays. There was no grand sort of plan. I would love to
claim. You went on vacation and you're like.
Yeah, I was literally going on vacation for 2 weeks and I was like, I want to read some good scripts because everything I've been reading recently has been mediocre. How can I find good scripts? Okay, I'll take a survey of everybody and find out what they loved. And then, if they're going to send me a list.
This was just like you emailing other people.
This was literally me emailing 75 people and saying, send me a list of your 10 favorite scripts that fit the following criteria. You love the script. You found out about the script this year. It won't be in production by the end of this calendar year. It was that simple. And I sent it back to everybody who voted and it sort of went viral in the industry very early on. I didn't have my name on it. I was convinced that I was going to get fired for having done it. And I kind of kept quiet for months that I had been the person. Like, some people knew, like my close friends knew that it was me. But, you know, I remember getting a phone call in June of that year from an agent trying to pitch me a new client, telling me that he had on good authority the script was going to be number one on the next year's blacklist, which was amazing because I had decided not to do it again. And it's also a survey. So, like, there's no way to have on good authority something like 6 months out.
Right.
It was just, you know, agents got agent. So... So yeah, there was no business model behind it. It was really just something that I was doing for myself. I recognized that it had value beyond it. It had value for me personally, but it also had value for the industry. So we just kept doing it on an annual basis.
And it wasn't like a startup. Like, you weren't like, oh, this is a
no, business. No. This was a survey. This was random weird thing that I was doing every December for 7 years. And then, you know, by 2010, this idea of a once yearly PDF that circulated via email had become positively adorable. You know, like in 2005, the notion of internet virality was still relatively new. Like, yeah. I sort of marked the time this way. The first blacklist went viral in Hollywood the same weekend that Lazy Sunday from Saturday Night Live went viral on the internet, which is like early days of YouTube. Yeah. Like, Twitter didn't even exist yet. Like, I think Facebook was still limited to like 10 or 15 colleges. So the idea of like sharing this kind of information and there being places where you could sort of express your opinion in a venue where a lot of other people could express their opinion and sort of see the aggregate consequence, it just wasn't there. But 5 years on, it, like, again, this you know, once yearly PDF that's circulated via email, it's like, oh, that's cute. Like, yeah. It's great what you're doing, great the influence it had, but like, step up your game. So I wanted to really create like a real-time version of that and sort of have, like, see what effect that could have. And so I built with my now business partner, Dino Siamich, who was an engineer at Akamai. You know, he built a website that functioned like a real-time blacklist. You know, industry professionals would get approved for membership. They could rate the scripts that they had read, and those ratings would aggregate to a best-of list that you could filter and sort along any dimension. We also added a recommendation algorithm that was, you know, built in part with the help of Sean Owen, who's now the VP of data science at Cloudera, like literally one of my college roommates. Mm-hmm. And in building that, we realized that we could also solve another problem that I had encountered in the business. And that was that, you know, after the blacklist sort of became a thing, I would get invited to do these like panel conversations about like breaking in as a screenwriter. And invariably, the first question that was asked of me was, you know, it's great that you made this list that helps people who are already represented get the credit they deserve for their good, weird scripts. But I wrote what I think is a pretty good script, and I don't know anyone in Hollywood. How do I get it to somebody who can do something with it? And I didn't have a good answer for that question. And I would ask people who were more senior in the business than I, what's the answer here? Like, how, if I live in Iowa and I don't know anyone who, you know, works in Hollywood, how do I get my screenplay? And they're like, well, you could enter the Nickel Fellowship, which is the screenwriting competition run by the Academy. And if you place in the top 30, someone will probably call you. And then the other advice was like, you know, move your life to Los Angeles, right. Get a job at Starbucks and network yourself until someone pays attention. And both of those are like, I'm an enormous admirer of the Nickel Fellowship. What they've done over the last 30 years is amazing, but it's a once a year proposition. And it's an imperfect system. Not that ours is perfect, but it's inefficient in the way that sort of anything that doesn't exist in real time is. And then this like move to LA thing, like that's good advice if you're an upper middle class kid and like, you know, your dad can pay the bills for you. Like if you're, you know, a single mom in Chicago or like you've got a mortgage and two kids in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, like not only is it not good advice, you can't do it. It's just not an option. And I think as a consequence, you end up with an industry that is primarily populated by people who come from those upper middle class backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I think the culture that the industry produces is that. And I think more than that, just because you don't have the ability to move to LA doesn't mean you're not a good writer. In fact, I would argue that it's probably inversely correlated with being a good writer. Like I'll take the person who's lived 20 years and got a mortgage and got two kids for their insights into what it means to be human over the 21-year-old who just graduated and is driving a BMW because their parents pay for it.
Yeah.
So we launched this website. We basically said anyone on earth who's written an English language screenplay can host their script on our site for $25 a month. We hired a team of readers who would evaluate those scripts for $50 per evaluation. And if the script is good, we tell the entire industry, like, hey, there's a great script over here. You should pay attention. And then we sort of step aside. You know, I've joked about it being eHarmony for people who write movies and people who make movies.
Yeah.
And it started as a joke, but increasingly I realized that that's actually a really good description because, you know, we will charge you to get to meet somebody, but we're not going to show up on your wedding night asking for 10%.
Right. You're not saying, you know, when this movie gets made, we're stuck with you. You're stuck with us.
Yeah, no, not at all. I think, you know, we are a platform by which writers who have the goods can get discovered, and whereby people who can make movies or move things forward can find the proverbial needles in a haystack.
So I've known, you know, about the Blacklist through you, but I did not really understand that there's a little bit of a mission behind it. There's like a democratization of.
Yeah. I mean,
opportunity.
It is. I think it's two things. One, it really is. First and foremost, we're about finding great stories that are well told and helping them get made, sort of being a catalyzing effect in those movies getting made. I think part and parcel of that, though, is recognizing that just because someone lives in L.A. or can afford to live in L.A. doesn't mean they have exclusive rights on talent. Mm-hmm. And the idea that the talent can come from anywhere, and if talent can come from anywhere, then there needs to be an infrastructure that allows that talent to be discovered. And I think, look, I grew up as a black kid in South Georgia. Access issues are a preoccupation of mine because I know that had I not had two amazing parents who were upper middle class and I hadn't gone to Harvard, I would not be working here. And I know tons of people who, you know, were sort of faced with the question of, do I go pursue my artistic dream that I've had since I was a kid, or do I go take a job at Goldman Sachs that I've been offered after graduation? And when you're the first in your family to go to college and you've got to support your parents or your grandparents, take the Goldman job, because, you know, eventually you can go back and do the artistic thing. And I think that there's probably over decades, over generations, there are movies that I have not gotten to see because the people who would have made them just didn't have the opportunity to be involved in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And selfishly, as a movie fan, like, that makes me sad. Like, I like watching good movies. There are missed opportunities out there. I want to create as many opportunities there for me to great movies as possible. And as someone also who sort of relies on film to see the world differently than I otherwise would. I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why I love film and television and fiction and all kinds of things. I want there to be as many different kinds of stories possible, so I can imagine being, you know, in any different social context in the world. I think that's sort of the value of art and the value of storytelling.
So I want to dive into a little bit of, from what I understand, when the Blacklist was a cute PDF in an email. Yeah. You had a full time job then, right?
Yeah,
like, that wasn't paying the bills. Clearly,
no, not at all. I was a development executive at Leonardo DiCaprio's company. I was a development executive at Sidney Pollack and Anthony Minghella's company before they died. I was a director of development at Universal Pictures. Like, I worked on Fast and Furious 5 and It's Complicated as a junior executive there. I was a vice president at Will Smith's company, Overbrook. It was always this side thing that I did, really, so that I could do my day job better.
You're an entrepreneur, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I try not to think of myself that way because I have panic attacks. But no, yeah. When I left Overbrook 2.5 years ago, right after the Toronto Film Festival, I sort of went all in on the Blacklist and decided to turn into a business. And that has been pretty much all I do since September 2012.
And do you guys have investors? Or are you bootstrapped?
No, we're totally bootstrapped. We've raised no money. My partner Dino and I own it outright. And I think, again, and the reason we did that, look, I maybe I'm just terrible at business and I'm willing to cede that possibility. But at 30,000 feet, I kind of really believe that if we nail the mission on this one, which is identifying great material, making sure that material gets made, like, the money will follow. Mm-hmm. Figuring out exactly how so, it's a different question. But we sort of had this weird runway of building the brand of the Blacklist and sort of proving the thesis that if you crowdsource from an intelligent crowd, you can identify good material. Like, we had proved our value. We had proved our case before we launched the monetized version of the business. Mm-hmm. So when we launched, we were profitable day one. You know, people were uploading scripts. We were identifying scripts. People were getting signed. And that, like, success begat more success. But yeah, and then right now, you know, the fees that we charge to host the scripts and you know, pay for the script evaluations, that allows us to continue to do that and other things like the podcast and these live stage readings that we do. And we host screenwriting labs. We did an annual one in Las Vegas each of the last 2 years, and we've sort of broken that up into smaller regional labs. We did one in New York last month. We'll do another one in Chicago, San Francisco, and LA later this year.
So we don't have investors here, and we are proud of it, but also happy in a day-to-day life that we don't like really answer to anybody. Which,
yeah, it's huge.
Do you feel like the future of your company is to remain kind of independent like it is now?
I'd like to remain as independent as we can for as long as we can. And I think the reason for that is that you know, once you take money, or when someone gives you money, they have the reasonable expectation that you are doing everything you can 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, to give them as big a return on that money as possible. Mm-hmm. Like that is a reasonable expectation from someone giving you money. For me, I want to be focused less on delivering a return on investment, at least in the short term, than I want to be focused on the mission. And I think nailing the mission, particularly for us working the way that we do in the industry, requires a much slower approach to growth. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be pressured into making decisions that I think are bad for the industry and bad for writers. Because for financial reasons.
Oh, I get it. Well, I mean,
I think it's probably the same thing.
It is. We make shows that we really don't think are going to make any money just because we're like, this is part of our mission. We love this artist, or we think the community will really appreciate it. And it's a great part of it.
It's the same idea. I mean, like, you know, we've been doing these live staged readings of scripts from the annual Blacklist here in Los Angeles at the Montalban Theater. And everyone's like, are you making money? I'm like, look, these are basically operated at a loss right now. The reason we do them is because they're a great night of entertainment. It's helping the writer get the news of their script and how good it is out to the industry. And, you know, selfishly and somewhat pragmatically, it's good for the brand. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, is there a more sort of profit-optimizing approach to running our business? Absolutely. Could we charge a lot more for the service we provide to writers? Definitely. We tested prices. Demand's super inelastic. We set the prices as low as we could that would allow us to sustain the business and like actually take some shots at growing different things.
Great. I want to talk about the Blacklist table reads.
Yeah, let's
do it. I'm very attached to that personally.
Ditto, and we're so glad that you are.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the podcast.
Today's episode is brought to you by Heineken Subway Symphony. 20 years ago, James Murphy came up with an idea to change the harsh turnstile beeps of the New York City subway into music. He calls it Subway Symphony. Instead of hearing this cacophony of stressful-sounding beeps, you would hear something pleasant and even calming. And during rush hour, when more people are passing through the turnstiles, this effect would be even more pronounced. For years, his idea kind of just sat there. But recently, Murphy got together with Heineken. And since Heineken believes in making cities greater, they've teamed up to make Subway Symphony happen. The goal is to generate support to make Subway Symphony a reality. The turnstiles have to make a sound, so why not make it a beautiful sound? If you want to help make Subway Symphony happen, it's really easy. Just use the hashtag Subway Symphony to share your support. Subway Symphony is just the first in a series of legacy projects backed by Heineken. Heineken wants to champion those who have an idea to make their city greater. So be on the lookout for more projects in cities across the country in the future. Watch the documentary of the journey to make Subway Symphony a reality and learn more about the project at subwaysymphony.com.
Okay, we're back with Franklin Leonard, CEO and founder of The Blacklist, also the co-creator of the Blacklist Table Reads podcast on the Wolf Pop Network. Yeah. I'm really excited about that. So, you know, this is a podcast that for us has been just a great project to work on, really flexing kind of all of our creative muscles, and one that we've been excited about from the moment that, you know, we talked about it. And I think it would be awesome if you could sort of tell the story of how it came together, and I'll fill it in too. But honestly, I was thinking about it, and I don't even know what preceded our initial meeting, like in that conference room, in the next room right there.
Really? Because
like,
I
ended up in that room, and I was like, and I was thinking back, like, what came before that? And I don't know.
So it's interesting. And I don't remember that meeting because I was like so anxious about pitching you guys on the idea that I have no memory at all of what was actually
so
said.
We were just plopped into a room somehow.
Yeah. So here's how I remember it. So I was not a big podcast listener until around April, May of last year, 2014. And I started listening to podcasts because a colleague, we hired a young woman named Kate Hagen, who's now our director of community at The Blacklist. And she's a big podcast listener. And I was like talking about how I was complaining about how I was driving around in LA because I was always stuck in traffic and I was going from meeting to meeting, which is sort of just the reality of the business at the stage that we're in. And I just was tired of listening to music and I couldn't listen to public radio anymore. She's like, you should listen to podcasts. And I was like, yeah, I thought about it. I just haven't gotten around to figuring out how to use the podcast app like on my iPhone. And I think I didn't have Bluetooth at the time. Like it was like an old Prius. And so I couldn't, like, I had to like, I don't even remember the process of like actually connecting it to hear something from my phone. But so I was like, what should I listen to? And she was like, you should listen to this podcast. How Did This Get Made? It's hilarious. You'll really like it. So I started listening to How Did This Get Made? I like listened to the most recent episode. I listened to like two of the most recent episodes, and then I went back to like episode one, and that became like all I listened to for weeks at a time when I was driving around.
How Did This Get Made? So you listened to the entire library.
I have listened to the entire to literally every minute of How Did This Get Made? All like I think it's over 100 episodes now, right? Like,
yeah, I'm pretty sure.
And I've listened to all of the mini episodes, like literally every minute. It was weird actually meeting Paul for the first time because I feel like we knew each other, but it was just because I had listened to him for literally over 100 hours. So I listened to all that. Then, you know, the Serial phenomenon happened. I started listening to Serial and started listening to more and more podcasts. Around that time, like in June of 2014, we did our first live stage table read as part of the Los Angeles Film Festival. So I guess it was early June. And it went over really well. It was for a script called 1969, A Space Odyssey, or How Kubrick Learned to Stop Worrying and Land on the Moon. It was a script speculating that Kubrick had faked the moon landing. It was great. Wow. We had Jared Harris and Catherine Hahn. It was and a bunch of the cast of Mad Men. It was a really, really good read. We had several, like, I think 600 or 700 people there. And so we started doing these on a regular basis, and we would promote them via Twitter and via email to our email list and say, hey, we're doing this event. It's going to be awesome. You should come. And we got a lot of tweets and emails from people saying, this sounds amazing, but I don't live in Los Angeles. I'm never going to be in Los Angeles. Can you live stream it? Can you sell a video copy of it? And, you know, the answer, unfortunately, was no, because a lot of to get a lot of the actors that we get, we kind of have to say, this won't be recorded. It's for that night in that room alone. But it started begging the question for me of, is there a way that we could do a version of that that I think would be both entertaining but also educational to aspiring screenwriters from outside of LA? And what would that look like if we did? And I sort of struck on the idea. I think I might have just been like on Amazon one night and like looking at random books about writing and found like a book on radio writing, and that like triggered it. I'm not sure what happened. But I do remember that right around that time, so this would have probably been fall of 2014, I got an email from Paul's agent basically saying, hey, I know you're doing the live reads. If you ever have a part for Paul, he'd love to do one.
And so this was after you had done your binge, so like your How Did This Get Made binge, right?
So I'd already done the How Did This Get Made binge. We started doing these live reads. People were asking like, hey, how can I see this? But I can't because I don't live in LA. Uh-huh. And I didn't have a good answer for it. And then I get this email from Paul's agent saying, hey, if you ever have a role for Paul, he'd be down. And that, I think, triggered the like, we should do a podcast and we should do it with Earwolf, because I just felt like sensibility-wise it fit. I knew your offices were literally like around the corner from my apartment.
It's a convenient
factor. Yeah, it's amazing in LA how often that triggers decisions. But so I emailed him back and I was like, look, yes, whenever we do, I'll definitely let you know, but I have an idea for something else. Is there a way you can set up a meeting for Paul and I? And that was the meeting that you were in, which I think was like early December at that point. Maybe the list was already out. It was like mid-December. And I remember going in.
The list wasn't out, but it was coming out.
It was about to get out the next week.
Exactly.
That's right. It was a week before. Because I remember like going back and like having to do the final.
You were like, I can only half pay attention to this meeting because I am like,
I was like super stressed. Yeah. I was like, I had to go back. I think I had to go back home from that meeting and like copy edit the list to make sure there like no grammatical errors.
You were like
errors.
Deep in.
Yeah. I was deep in blacklist hell. And it was also like the 10th anniversary list. So we were having like a party that Monday night to like celebrate it. And it was a fundraiser for the Young Storytellers Foundation, which is this amazing nonprofit that does like screenwriting work with young kids and disadvantaged schools here in the LA area. So I remember coming up to the office and I remember being like super nervous to pitch it and thinking that you guys were just going to be like, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. So I have no memory of the meeting at all. I remember like rambling. I remember sort of pitching it and saying, hey, we have access to these great scripts. I think we can get talent. I think we should do it as one script every month, chop it up into four episodes. So it's about 30 to 45 minutes for each podcast. And then sort of sitting there being like, all right, they're going to kick me out. And you guys being like, that sounds great. Let's do it. And I was just like, cool. Terrific.
Yeah. Well, when you left, it was one of those things where like Paul just came into my office and we just both looked at each other. Like we didn't even have to say anything. We just looked at each other and we're like, yeah, this is one of the best
That's
things
awesome.
We've heard. Like this is a no-brainer.
Yeah. I think I actually maybe even listened. There might have been like a Wolf Den episode. Maybe it was you and Matt Gorley.
And Paul. Yeah, there was
we're
one
talking about, right, because this was right after you guys had just announced Wolf Pop.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember listening to the episode, and you guys were talking about, like, what you look for in your podcast hosts. And like the main thing was like enthusiasm and passion. And I was like, all right, that I can sell. Like that I know I have. And I think there's like, we have access to scripts. I know that. So like rationally it makes sense and hopefully they like it. But I gotta be honest, there was definitely a moment after you guys said yes, sort of before the first one happened, where I was like, oh, what the hell have I gotten myself into? But you know, so far so good. It seems to be working.
Yeah. So for the listeners, like if you and I've actually promoted the show on the Wolf Den, so hopefully that's worked and you've gone and listened to it. But it's the show is basically you choose. Is it you? Are you the single selector?
Kind of, in the sense that well, yes and no, right? So you know, we have this website that has had 20,000 screenplays submitted to it since it launched 2.5 years ago, and we use the evaluations of our paid readers, but also the ratings of industry professionals on these scripts to identify the strongest ones. And so what we're doing is we're sort of unearthing the best scripts on the site that are particularly strong in dialogue, because I think that fits best to the medium. Like, we're not going to do an action movie as a radio podcast. Like, it just doesn't work as well. So we're trying to identify the best of those. And then it's about, you know, amongst that top tier, identifying the ones that we think will be interesting for the medium. And then we reach out to the writers and say, hey, we want to do this. Are you cool with it? And most seem to be.
And so what in practicality, what happens is there's a table read in the studio.
Yeah.
We've recorded one here in LA. We recorded one in New York.
Two in LA. Yeah, we did two in LA. We recorded one last week and one in New York, which was crazy. And then the next few will obviously be here in LA.
And then our kind of like production team goes to work and turns it
and does
from
a
table read
phenomenal
into
job
into an ear movie, as I call it, which is really like it's and engineer Cody deserves a lot of credit.
Cody deserves a ton of credit. Yeah. It's really interesting because I definitely. My initial instinct was, no, we just record the table read and put it out.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Like, what do you think about – because you said a lot of the kind of like start of the idea came from you having these live table reads and people wanting access to it. So this is not exactly that, because this is –
It's not different. Exactly that. It's sort of that plus. Yeah. You know, I think when you go to a live table read, you're seeing you're hearing it obviously, but the actors are giving performances and there's interaction between the actors on stage. And I think that that gives you like that takes you further than just hearing the audio of what the actors are saying. I, in my general ignorance about sort of podcasting and radio, figured that like just the recording would be enough. And I remember. I think weeks before, like maybe a week before we recorded the first script, Chris Bannon came on and he and I met up in New York. I happened to be in New York and we had breakfast and he was like, I think we should think seriously about, you know, adding some real production. And to be honest, it wasn't that I was skeptical. It was just that I was just like, oh, that seems like a lot of work. And like, I don't want to put people out. And he was adamant about it and he was 100% right. I mean, 1,000% right. Like the elevation of the audio from just the read to, you know, you add the work that Cody has done on these episodes, it does. It changes it from I'm listening in on a table read to I'm listening to an ear movie. And that's really exciting. I think it is a large part of what differentiates it in the marketplace. And it really does make it into something that's exceptional that I'm enormously proud of. But I can't take any credit for it because I'm not doing the post on it. So credit goes to Cody and Chris for really pushing me on it.
They both deserve a ton of credit. And you're now directing. You've directed the one that has not come out yet.
Yeah, I'm sort of in there now. It's if you had told me that I would be like, you know, one of the country's premier directors of radio drama and host of radio drama even a year ago, I would have thought you were on some pretty heavy drugs. But that is what I find myself doing a lot of the time now. Yeah.
This is one of those where I feel like this is – without sounding too like hyperbolic, I feel like there's something really new about this and I feel like we're learning as we go. Like,
oh yeah,
you know, I think we're gonna see a real trajectory as we see each film. They're gonna change because we're gonna learn. Like, for example, we had in the first film, which was Balls Out, an absolutely amazing and hilarious script.
Yeah, so funny that you could hear the actors laughing during the.
That was one of the things I was gonna say. It's like the actors were laughing the entire time because it's really funny.
Right.
And the newest film, which is also a comedy, I think is not going to have any laughs.
It's not going to have. Yeah, there's no laugh track, intentional or otherwise. Yeah, because we realized that, you know, with the production, it doesn't make sense to have that. Like, yeah. It should be a sort of a pure experience. And yeah, I think I am definitely learning as I go. I'm, again, sort of standing on the shoulders of people like Chris and Greta and Cody and Paul in the process. But it's exciting because, yeah, I genuinely do believe that each script, each sort of recording is going to be better than the last. Mm-hmm. And given the access to great scripts that we have and the access to great actors that we have, like it would, like, the sky's the limit. And it's really just sort of on me to not be too boring as the host.
And from the writer's perspective, are they excited to be selected for this?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, the first four writers were selected. We reached out to them before the first episode had gone live. So I think that there was some amount of, like, I don't know exactly what this is, mm-hmm. But they were definitely enthusiastic, and I think that they trust sort of who the Blacklist is and what we've done historically as being an advocate for writers, that it wouldn't be a bad thing. But I think now, just given the enthusiasm that I've heard from the audience, I can't imagine, unless, like, a writer is in the middle of a deal to sell their script, it's really hard for me to imagine a scenario where they wouldn't be excited to sort of have this thing performed, have tens of thousands of people hear their work, and make it more likely that their movie gets made. Because, you know, it's one thing to read the script. It's a different thing to hear an ear movie. And it also means that, like, you know, everyone in Hollywood can sort of get in their car and listen to it. Like, that's dead time for them. They're either rolling calls, which they don't want to do, and they're wishing they could read a script. Yeah, that would be great. Exactly. So we're sort of giving we're like, hey, you got nothing else to do. Why don't you listen to this thing that maybe you might want to buy and make? So,
and have the writers push back saying, I'm concerned that if a studio hears this in your movie, they're going to think, okay, that's been done, and I don't want to make it as a—
No one's expressed that concern to me. Yeah, was Hunger Games less successful because it existed in book form first? Like, you know, I think if anything, I think it's more likely that these movies will get made because they're in this form and because, you know, like, look, the industry is all about pre-branded content, right? Like, you can sell a comic book to a studio more easily than you can an original idea, even if the comic book's only sold 10,000 copies. Well, tens of thousands of people are listening to these episodes. So, like, you know, if you can capture, like, let's say that, you know, one of these scripts was listened to by 50,000 people consistently across four episodes. Mm-hmm. If you can capture all 50,000 or even 80, like, that's $400,000 at the box office. Yeah. Like, for an indie movie, that's no insignificant thing. So I think my hope is that people will recognize that this is a great opportunity to identify material that they should be making. And I think hopefully our audience will continue to grow, and it'll almost be a no-brainer. And I think it's going to take one script selling after having been on the podcast for the entire dynamic to change in that
regard. Yeah, I agree. And are there any scripts that you choose because you think this would never work as a movie?
Well, Balls Out was that. Yeah, I mean, look, the first one, which did not come from the website, was specifically chosen because it's sort of legendary in the industry, this script that was sort of written by these, like, represented writers.
You want to talk about Balls Out for a
second? Yeah, let's talk about it for a second. So this was a script that Malcolm Spellman and Tim Talbot, they were writers during the middle of the strike. They were writers they had never met. They met on, like, a WGA message board online, and they realized they had a similar sense of humor. And they met up and they decided to write, you know, the script that was going to rescue them from the doldrums of their career. Like, they were writing for, like, you know, CSI Cleveland or something like that. And they wanted to be doing something different. So they wrote this comedy called Balls Out that was intended to be both a sort of perfect execution of the sort of, like, guy wish fulfillment comedy, but also, like, a brutal satire of the guy wish fulfillment comedy. And they put it under the pen name the Robotard 8000. Well, actually, no. First, they gave it to their agents and said, we want to go out with the script as representation of our new work. And their agents all said, we can't do this in good conscience. Like, one of their reps said, like, I would have to get special dispensation from the head of the agency to send this script out with our, like, script covers on it. And so they said, okay, forget it. We're going to put it online, literally under the pen name, the Robotard 8000. And that's what they did. They sort of made this, like, terrible, like, early 90s website and made the script available with, like, you know, quotes of support from their writer friends. Yeah. And it was crazy because people started reading the script. There were rumors that it was, like, Akiva Goldsman and, like, Aaron Sorkin or something had written it, and they were just trying to, like, try out comedy. And then when I did the annual Blacklist voting, I kept getting these votes for Balls Out by the Robotard 8000. And I remember it like it was yesterday, seeing these votes for this script and thinking, oh, well, I guess the blacklist is over. Like, people are fucking with it now. Yeah. Like, this is clearly just people are like, they're tired of it. They're making scripts up.
One giant prank on you.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, you know what? I respect it. I totally understand it. I'd probably do the same thing if I was voting for something like this. And so I called a few people that had voted for it, or I emailed a few people that had voted for it and said, hey, is this a real script? No harm, no foul. If it's not, I just have to know before I put this thing out. They're like, no, it's real. Like, you can download it. Here's the link. And I downloaded it. And I was like, okay, well, now I can't put the Robotard 8000 as the writer of record on the list. So I was like constantly trying to figure out, and I can't even remember to this day who told me who they were, but I actually ended up outing them as the writers when the list came out. And then in the weeks following, everyone read it. People loved the script. They had meetings with like pretty much every important comedy person in the industry, and their careers have flourished. I don't think because of the blacklist, but I think they got a ton of attention that allowed them to take advantage of it. Tim just won the screenwriting award at Sundance this year for Stanford Prison Experiment. Malcolm is a senior producer on Empire. Like, they're doing all right.
Yeah.
So that one we wanted to do as the first one because it was, you know, our business is now this website that helps writers get their work to Hollywood. It's sort of the first script that had been on a website and sort of made its way into Hollywood. It was on the annual blacklist. They're also a great interview, Malcolm and Tim. And I thought it would be a really funny way to start out.
And it was also easy for us to tap our family.
It was
family,
super right? easy to tap immediate and extended Earwolf and Wolfpop family to do it. So that one just kind of made sense. I think since then, look, I actually believe that there are very few scripts that can't theoretically get made. It's just a matter of figuring out the business model behind making them. Like, mm-hmm. you're not going to make a movie for $200 million that has an audience of 1 million. But if you can figure out how to make that movie for $100,000, do it. So I think what I'd say is that a lot of the scripts that we'll do on the podcast will be things that are a little left of center, a little ambitious. They'd be a little unusual. They're not going to be the things that most people in Hollywood read and say, oh, that's box office gold.
Like that, and maybe that's our second film, which is, I think, great.
Yeah. The Other Side is a coming-of-age drama set at the nexus of the Hasidic and hipster community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Like, that is not something that the studios are like, I'm going to make $100 million that way. But the common thread to all of these, no matter what genre, no matter what story is being told, is that they're going to be best in class from like a screenwriting execution standpoint. And that's really sort of what the blacklist brings to the table, is the ability to discover and unearth these things more quickly than other folks. I think it's really exciting. One script that I would have loved to have had on it, but it just didn't work out that way, is The Imitation Game, right? Like, no one in Hollywood would have said, oh yeah, give me that gay cryptographer biopic. That's gonna be my ticket to a $100 million movie and Oscars. But it was exceptionally well done. And I think that you absolutely could have made that script as an ear movie and people would have been into it. So, it's really just about finding best in class. And honestly, we're going to experiment with a bunch of different genres. We've got a Jane Austen-esque, like, period, 19th century English period drama coming up. That
I'm
is going to be
that one.
What? Yeah,
I'm
it's a really good script too, and I think it's but it's not going to be for everybody. But I think it's going to be for a lot of people, and hopefully the people that don't think it's for them stick around and listen to it, and there's a good chance they're going to discover that it is.
And do we have from the actor side? Are actors now kind of like asking to be a part of it?
We're definitely starting to get more of that. I think I'm still spending a lot of time casting it because we want to cast up and make sure we get really strong actors for each of the roles. I think that in my experience, actors love the opportunity to do good work with great scripts. And we're giving them an opportunity to do an entire character in like 3 hours of work.
Yeah.
So I think as more and more people become aware of it, I think you're going to see some bigger and bigger and more talented folks doing it. But I've really just been, incredibly humbled, frankly, by the people that we've already had do it. I mean, look, Darren Criss went from I think he opened Hedwig. Like, he premiered, his debuted as Hedwig on Broadway the night before we recorded the Other Side. Showed up the next morning with a sinus infection at like 9 a.m. and then left and went to the doctor and then to the theater to do his second night of Hedwig. We had Jerry Adler from The Sopranos. Like, so yeah. We're getting, and I think it's really fun too to get these actors who, you know, people would recognize by face, but maybe not by name, but are really good actors who can do a great performance.
And you hear Jerry Adler's voice.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's Hesh from The Sopranos. Like, I remember him talking to Tony, or Bill Raymond, who was the Greek from season two of The Wire. Like, that's just really cool to me. So I think it's really for me about finding ways to get, you know, names, obviously, but also folks who are down to sort of experiment and get in a, you know, a hot studio and record a table read for a podcast.
It's really hot in there with all those bodies.
For no money. I think it's a certain kind of personality.
And do you think that there's an untapped – so now looking at kind of like the podcast – you're a podcast fan as of, you know, a year ago. Do you think that this – that there's more opportunity for more like radio drama type, you know, fictional
narrative? I hope so. I mean, look, I hope that we're sort of the first and that there are going to be many who do it again. I don't know what it looks like necessarily, right? Like, I think part of the problem and part of the challenge is that – creating fictional content requires extraordinary amounts of resources, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so if I'm going to write something specifically, if I'm going to write an episodic drama, I'm going to want to write it probably for the most lucrative venue for it. And that's going to be TV or film.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know that there are going to be that many writers who set out to write, you know, a radio drama or like an episodic radio drama or a podcast drama, because there's more money to be made elsewhere.
Yeah.
But I think as the audience for podcasts continues to expand and the sort of money that like for advertising and stuff like that continues to expand, I don't see any reason why there wouldn't be. And I actually think what's really exciting about that is that I think you'll end up finding more artistically and emotionally ambitious stuff in this realm because there's not the extraordinary resource expenditure to make it, right? Like it doesn't cost us $10 million or $1 million to make every episode of this podcast. And as a consequence, we don't have to make $1 million from every episode of the podcast. It'd be nice, but, you know, and even if we did, it wouldn't mean that we needed to spend $1 million to do it. So I think that sort of like those economic conditions present a really interesting opportunity over time. But until there's more money to be made from it, I think it'll only be folks that really care about storytelling that are doing it. And that's sort of where we find ourselves right now.
And how does this podcast fit into your like your business strategy, your overall strategy?
I think, again, it sort of comes down to this question of mission over money. Like the financial windfall from the podcast is not a priority or really anything that I think about. For me, I have three goals with the podcast. The first is create entertainment for people that want to listen. That's one. Number two is elevate the profile of the writers and the scripts that we're doing in the podcast, make it more likely that those scripts get made, make it more likely that those writers get hired, and ideally give those writers some ownership of their audience so that when they go to a financier for their movie, they can say, look, my audience is going to show up for me. I'm worth hiring both because I do good writing, but because like my audience will show up. And then the third part is I think it's a really solid brand expansion for the Blacklist. You know, we are well known and well liked, and I think well respected in the film industry. And I think increasingly there will be people who don't work in the film industry or aren't total cinephiles who may know what the Blacklist is. But I think it has the real value for us is that there are a large number of people who are now familiar with who we are and what we do and the way we see the world.
Well, that's awesome. You know, I really it's something that we're just so proud to have and really we're so proud of where it is today and also so just thrilled about where we feel like this thing is going
to
go.
Yeah, we feel the same way and we're proud to be partners with you guys on it. It's like I said, I was so nervous in that first meeting with you and Paul. I was like, they're going to think I'm an idiot. But it's been amazing. And I think, you know, I owe you guys an enormous debt of gratitude just and sort of bearing with me as I sort of get my feet underneath me in doing it. But also, like I said, the sort of post work, and the guidance that I've gotten from the team here has just been absolutely invaluable and it definitely would not be what it is without that. So
we do have an awesome team. So
yeah,
I agree. They deserve a ton of credit.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Where can people find you and the podcast?
Let's see the podcast, iTunes on the Wolf Pop website,
Blacklist.wolfpop.com.
blacklistpop.com. The Blacklist website is blcklst.com. It's Blacklist with no vowels. Or just Google Blacklist and screenplay. We'll be the first thing mentioned. I'm on Twitter as at Franklin Leonard. The Blacklist is on Twitter as at the blcklst. Again, you can just search for the Blacklist. It'll come up. And the Blacklist table reads is the blcklsttr.
Just go to Wolf Pop.
Just go to Wolf Pop. All the links are there. Or just go to our website, which again, blacklistwithnovowels.com. All the links are there. That's how to find us on the web. Google's a great tool for finding pretty much anything. That's why they exist.
I've heard it works.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So anyway, thank you so much for being here. Everybody, definitely go out and check out this podcast. It's really something that is special and different and I think like nothing you've ever heard before.
Yeah. Ear movies. They're amazing. Listen to the podcast. Check out the website. There's laughter. There's tears. There's literally the full range of human emotion for your home, for your car, for your subway commute.
That's right. Wow. What a pitch. Thanks, Franklin. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please subscribe to the show at earwolf.com or on iTunes. Rate and review our show and The Blacklist. There's always some sort of like you guys are giving.
Yeah, if you're an aspiring screenwriter and you review the podcast, we give away a month of screenplay hosting for one person who's reviewed the show per week. And follow us on Twitter. Check out the website. We get our Oprah on all the time.
All right. Until next time. Happy podcasting.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio. Boom.com. The wolf dead.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Reza Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.